Hey, guys. I'm Uncle Jim. I am grateful to know I'm an alcoholic. I had the privilege today of giving our speaker tonight, Pat O., a nice phone call. Just to let you know, he's from Fullerton, California. He was born and raised in Mission Viejo, and he had to teach me how to spell that. If you don't know, it's V-I-E-J-O. It's not V-I-L-L-E-J-O, as I first thought it was spelled. He got a sobriety, though, in the little town of Laguna Beach. And I was thinking that that would be a good place to drink over there. But, man, he's been sober for 17 years. He sponsors people. And he had a little expression that I love. He said, if you don't drink, you won't get drunk. If you don't get drunk, your life will get different. He did have a very special person pass away recently that I was privileged to hear years ago, back in 2017, at one of our Spring into Sobriety events. But if you don't mind, why don't we give Pat O. from Fullerton a big warm round of Valley Group applause.
Thank you, Jim. What a kind welcome. My name is Pat, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm grateful to be sober. I'm grateful to be here. I want to thank Tammy for asking me. I think Bill for referring me. Jim for the nice welcome. And I want to thank your group for being here. And this Zoom thing is awkward, isn't it? You know what I mean? It's like I'm rocking a mullet right now. You know what I'm saying? It's like business on the top and party on the bottom. I got shorts and slippers on. Nah, I got to be honest, Monica. If I hold them secrets, I'll be out doing some weird stuff. And next thing you know, more secrets, shame and guilt. It all starts with one little silly one like that, you know. And you know, the Zoom world's really weird. Those that have their video on, thank you very much, because it's like I'm in my living room talking to myself. You know what I'm saying? And so the people that are on here, like, thanks, because there's like a little bit of connection. You know, Jim's over there eating. I'm like, can I have a bite, Jim? You know, and there's my boy, the 49er hat on. That's right. And he just turned his video on. You don't have a name, so. But, you know, it's just a weird thing, man. Zoom. I don't know about you guys, but I'm a chronic malcontent. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's like when we were in the meetings, I was, you know, oh, man, I got to drive an hour to get to my meeting. And, oh, geez, I got to, you know, oh, rah, rah, rah. And, oh, man, that character and this character. And then you take the meeting away, and I'm like, no, where's my meetings? I want my meetings. You know, and then I start complaining about Zoom and grateful for the meetings, you know. And it's just like, wow, crazy, you know. And it's so powerful to watch how God has worked, you know, through this process. None of us thought in the third edition, right? Modem to modem, Zoom to Zoom, you know what I mean? And then, you know, the next edition will have some emojis in there with a zoom little car going, you know, and, you know, we got to keep up with the times, you know, and so we can reach a broader section of the world, you know, and, but the Zoom, it's been such a powerful experience, right? I want to thank the servants of this group, the servants of Alcoholics Anonymous of this group, right? In the time when it was like, oh, my God, we're not going to have meetings, and what are we going to do? And the world's ending, right? Remember that day, right? And all of a sudden, the servants were like, here's a link, and then sent the link to everybody, right? And we're like, oh, my God, yay! And the long-timers, I still call them old-timers, so I apologize if it offends anyone. The long-timers, right? They didn't know what to do, right? Like, I could barely get on the computer, you know what I'm saying? And then there's a service opportunity for me to reach out to a long-timer, my group, and bring them into the fold, right? So that they could be a part of, so that they can have the recovery that they crave, like all of us, you know? And so I want to thank the servants of this group who came together and put this on, and those that show up every week you know, and keep a safe place for the newcomer. And we had some newcomers tonight, and I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. What a weird time to get sober. You know, this Zoom thing has broken all the rules that they said before Zoom. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I have sponsees that I've met, you know, that are in different states. I never met them, actually. Well, we've only worked through online, through Zoom or FaceTime or what, you know, and we sit down together. you know, across the kitchen table, you know, and we read the book, you know, and it's really cool how all this is happening. And I mean, I sure hope that we get to go back to meetings, because this is, you know, this is getting a little out of hand. You know what I'm saying? When I get back to a meeting, the first person I hug, man, I'm not even going to let go. I'm going to hold on their leg, you know, all awkward and weird. You know what I'm saying? It's going to be weird. But I'm not letting go, man. It's been just an interesting process, but I'm really grateful. You know, if you're new, I have a God in my life that I can do business with. If you're new, I didn't believe in God until I was 10 years sober. And if you're struggling with God, I just ask that you keep coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Right, I came to believe that AA worked, you know, and I want to thank the long timers that are here tonight for paving the way, for continuing to inspire me to show up to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, when I got down in prayer this morning, I asked God, I said, please, God, please, just to let me touch at least one person today. Let me help at least one person today. And, you know, I have a love affair with Alcoholics Anonymous that comes and goes, you know. And I have a home group. My home group's meeting right now, the same time your guys does, 7 to 8 on Zoom. We really meet at 8 o'clock in Laguna Beach at the Women's Club. You know, on a Wednesday night, and I love my home group. I'll never forget the first man that welcomed me at my home group. His name was John Ackerlin. John Ackerlin died with a lot of years sober, but I'll never forget the softness of that man's hand. And I remember him right when I walked up to the door. It's like a 250 person speaker meeting. You could hear the music of Alcoholics Anonymous inside, that chatter and that camaraderie and that laughter. You could hear it. It was electric, you know. And I remember walking up to him, and he put out his hand. And he said, "Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous, kid." And the guy brought me into the meeting. He took me to the back where the coffee is, and they used to have donuts. You know what I'm saying? They don't, you know, people don't want to donate anymore. We had to have a steering committee about that one. Get rid of the donuts were the first thing to go, you know. And I remember the donuts, they were cut in half even, you know what I'm saying? And they were hard, right? I found out later they're ones from the day before, you know, leftovers, because they donated them. You know what I mean? But he gave me a half a donut. And I thought to myself, I didn't say this, but I thought, I go, what a cheap guy, dude. Can't you give me a whole donut, you know? And then he gave me a half a cup of coffee, and I'm like, dude, this guy's really cheap, you know? But he knew better, man, because my hand was like vibrating, you know, the coffee wouldn't spill over with the half cup. He knew, you know, and he said, "Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous." He didn't care where I had been, who I had done it with. Was I an alcoholic? Was I an addict? He didn't care about any of that. He said, "Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous, kid." And he brought me all the way in, and he sat me all the way down, and he put me in the second row. Right? There's two big rows. There's 250 people in the meeting, and the second row, he sat me in the middle of these guys. And guys like Tommy Whalen, Lynn Wilder, Frank O'Rourke, Johnny Crink, guys with like 40 plus years, these guys were like giants, you know what I'm saying? They were like pillars. I'm like, not even one hit of weed or nothing? You know, they're like, nothing that fixes from the neck up, you know? And they sat me in the middle of those guys, man. Those guys just sat there and told me their stories. And they told their stories, and they told their stories, and they laughed, and they told their stories, and they laughed, and they told their stories, and I was enthralled by them. And I was like, whoa, man, these guys, you know, in back of my mind, I'm like, all they do is talk about themselves. But I was laughing with them, and then all of a sudden the meeting started, and I was like, wait a second, I gotta smoke a cigarette, and I gotta do all, because I got that, you know, that nervous disposition that the big book talks about. I got that, you know, and I'm like, oh my God, I gotta go. And John's like, oh no, the meeting's starting. I was like, but I gotta go. And now I'm stuck in the middle of these guys, and it was an hour and a half speaker meeting, and I don't know if you're new, if you can last an hour and a half, but I mean, I was like, but, you know, and John would put his hand on my leg, and he'd say, "Don't forget to breathe, kid." I'm like, "Oh yeah, breathe." You know, gee, settle down, you know, calm down. And then I got that anxiety, I got to get out and go smoke a cigarette or something. And he'd say, "We don't leave the meeting early." I said, "I got to go to the bathroom." He said, "It's disrespectful to get up in the middle of the meeting. Stay seated, you know." Okay. You know, I'm a firm believer that my character defect and wanting John to like me kept me doing what you guys told me to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I wanted that guy to like me, so I stayed there. You know, and then the end of the meeting, he goes, "Go thank the speaker." I was like, "I didn't even like the speaker. Why am I going to thank him?" He's like, "Well, he drove all the way from L.A. Why don't you go thank him for driving 3 hours?" You know, and then I got to stand in the greeting line. You know, I don't want to go smoke. I want to go talk to the girls. I want to do something. in the back, and now I got to wait in the greeting line for like what seemed like a lifetime. It's probably only 20 minutes, 15 minutes, but it seemed like hours. You know what I mean? Because I'm weird, I'm awkward. Like that's my true character, is like weird and awkward. I'm just like I'm like the little kid in elementary school that smells like poopy pants and syrup. You know what I mean? And like that's that natural state of me. And I'm standing in the greeting line, and people are like, "Hi, you know, what's your name?" I'm like, "I'm Pat." Oh God, I can't. Oh Jesus, too much. You know? And I get all the way up to the speaker. I'm like, "Thanks for driving from LA." And I'm out of the meeting. I'm out of here. You know? And I show up next week, and there's John. He did the same deal. You know what I mean? He did the same deal. And then I was sitting there before the meeting, and the leader came up to me, and she's like, "Oh, would you like to read the 12 traditions?" And John's like, "He's not reading." And my feeling was hurt, you know what I mean? My one feeling was hurt, you know what I mean? I was like, I mean, I didn't want to read anyways, but I was resentful I couldn't, you know? And John said, "He's not dressed appropriately to be behind the podium." I was like, "Man, geez, John, you're rough, you know?" And so the next week I showed up with a collared shirt because I wanted John to like me. And then they even asked me to read, and I was resentful again, you know? But I kept showing up with my collared shirt on, and you know, what that guy was doing for me was he was teaching me how to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. He was teaching me how to respect the thing that was going to save my life. It takes everything in me to wear a collared shirt when I go to my own group. You know what I mean? It takes everything in me to wear a collared shirt in my dining room. You know what I mean? It's like, dude, why do I got to do it in my dining room? You know what I'm saying? And I'm thinking, because I got that I want out. I want a way out. I'm always looking for the loophole. Any other loophole guys here? I'm looking for the loophole, even on a Wednesday night, 17 years sober. If you're new, my sobriety date's October 23rd, 2002. And I'm looking, I'm like, "Oh, I don't got to wear a tie and shirt tonight." I mean, you're in your dining room. You're invited, you know, Visalia, you know, they'll probably never see you again, you know. But I got John's voice. Respect Alcoholics Anonymous, kid. Respect Alcoholics Anonymous. Go show those good folks what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for you. And if you're new, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous on October 23rd, 2002, I was living off Skid Row. I hadn't showered in 6 months. I was up for 21 days on some high-powered accelerants. I had two shoes, only one had a sole. I was 98 pounds, and I was an absolute wreck. You know, and I sit here tonight in my chair in my own place that I pay rent for. You know, I have all the material things on the outside. Like, Alcoholics Anonymous is the single most important thing in my life. If you're new, what the long-timers or the old-timers taught me when I was new, they said, "You just say yes to Alcoholics Anonymous." I said, "Why do I got to say yes to Alcoholics Anonymous?" And they would say things like, "Well, because that's where God wants you to be." Whoa, mind blown. You know, I was like, well, that's profound. You know what I'm saying? And I don't know why God wants me here tonight. But for some reason, God wants me to be amongst you. And I said yes, and I'm grateful to be here. I'm truly grateful. I have a sponsor. His name is Mike Socchio. I love that man. That man knows absolutely everything about me. And I got some weird twisted fears and insecurities and awkwardness, right? Because I'm awkward, poopy pants kid, you know what I mean? And then I got that stuff naturally. That's who I am, you know what I mean? And so he knows everything about me. I talked to him today. You know, and if you're new, you know, they kind of blew it. They told you who my mom was. That quote that I said was my mom. So my mom got sober when I was 11 months old. My mom was being sentenced to prison for 10 years ago, the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. In the middle of the sentencing, the judge offered her to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. My mom's also a blackout drinker, which means I'll never know who my dad is. You know what I mean? For all I know, my dad could be the cable guy. You know, she even knows she was pregnant till she was in labor, which is, you know, awkward and weird. You know, and she gave birth, and the paramedics like, "You need to name him." You know, my mom's name, well, she passed away. Her name was Patty, so she named me Patrick so she wouldn't forget my name, right? And it doesn't make me alcoholic, right? It's just my story, right? It's just the weird, you know, the first 11 months of my life, I sat in a thing where kids sit on a pool table in a smoke-filled bar, and the women of that bar took care of me. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and my mom showed up with an only child, I have no brothers and sisters, the women in Alcoholics Anonymous took me, and my mom went in and recovered. And I'm so grateful that they didn't say, you know, "Our meeting doesn't have child care, you're not welcome here." You know, I've been hearing that quite a bit in Alcoholics Anonymous, women being turned away because there's no child care and there's no kids at the meeting. But I loved growing up in AA, man. The women spoil the heck out of me. You guys, man, I would show up to the meeting and you would take me outside and you would bring brownies and Rice Krispie treats and you'd have coloring books and you and for the weekend I'd hang out with you for the weekend. And, you know, I could recite chapter 5 when I was a kid. I could recite 12 traditions. I held hands. I'm like, keep coming back. I was like the poster boy for AA, little kid of AA. And, you know, my mom, there was, you know, there weren't detoxes everywhere like there are now. You know, they'd get the newcomer after the meeting and they'd take her to Denny's and they'd put her in the middle of the booth and they'd drink, you know, they'd drink coffee and smoke cigarettes until 2:15 and then they let her go after the bar closed, you know. And sometimes my mom would bring women home, they'd detox on her couch. I watched a woman die of this disease on my mom's couch, you know. If knowledge had anything to do with this disease, if love had anything to do with this disease, I'd never taken my first drink. You know, I knew what Alcoholics Anonymous was. I knew, I didn't know what alcoholism was, but I knew the effects that alcohol had on people, you know. And and I grew up in AA. Like, you know, I'll tell you what, my mom was my hero. And since I've been a little kid, you know, I remember telling my mom, like, I'm never going to drink. I'm never going to do drugs. You know, the DARE program came. I signed the pledge. You know what I mean? I got the little red band. You know, I'm just saying no, you know. And I meant it, you know, I meant it. And, you know, but I know that I have a disease of perception. If you're new, like, alcoholism is a disease of perception. Though I was raised with a lot of love, my perception to life is just a little, you know, twisted. You know what I mean? Because I remember, like, I'm a right fielder on the baseball team, and no one's going to admit it in the meeting. I know. No one admits right fielder. You know, we want to be the pitcher. We want to be the shortstop. You know, we want to be the most popular kid, you know. But I'm a right fielder. You know, the ball's never hit out there. Jim, thanks, Jim. Good looking out, brother. You know what I mean? Like, I'm, like, resentful at the pitcher. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm just like, eh, you know what I mean? You know, I throw the ball as hard as I can that way, and it goes, like, 5 feet that way. You know what I mean? It's just like I'm screwing it up all the time. One time I was on second base. I don't even know how I got there. I was so terrified. I was like, oh, my God. What a self-obsession, right? I didn't know if I had the right pants, the right cleats. And the kid cracked the line drive, and I ran back to first base. You know what I mean? And it was like a triple play in the wrong direction and little poopy pants back to the dugout. And as I'm going into the dugout, right, like all my friends are running out. And what I heard my friends say that day is, you're a failure, you're a loser, and you're no good. I have no idea where those thoughts came from, but that was the voice in my head long before I ever took my first drink. But I remember my mom, and she's in the stands clapping, and me so proud of her kid, you know. And not proud because I had a triple play in the wrong direction. My mom was proud of me because it took me an hour to get out of that stupid car to go to that stupid field to play that stupid game one more time. And my mom was proud of me that I had enough courage to get out of that car. But I remember looking at my mom that day saying, if I only had a dad, that had never happened. And I quickly built this belief system that was going to separate me from you, and I had no idea. I had no idea, you know. And I remember looking outside my mom's apartment window, like I mean, I'm a bedwetter until I'm 10. You know what I'm saying? And if you're a bedwetter, like, you know what's up. There's a lot of shame attached to that. You know what I mean? Now I know it was a ton of anxiety as a kid, you know. I didn't know that back then. It was just like Mike would invite me over for a sleepover, and I was terrified. You know what I mean? I was, like, terrified. You know what I'm saying? And sure enough, I'd wake up in the morning, and I'd pee your couch, and I'd flip the cushion over, and Mike never invited me back. You know what I'm saying? But I remember looking outside the window, like, waiting for my dad to come home, and all these cars would come, and, like, my dad would never come home. You know, and I built this belief that I wasn't lovable, right? That if my own father didn't love me, you know, then who would love me, you know? And, and that's, like, just the natural state of who, a little bit of who Pat O was before I drank alcohol. You know, I took my first drink of alcohol 9 years old. I don't know how old you guys were. I don't know where you were. None of that matters, right? But the effect that alcohol has on this alcoholic body is what matters for me, right? I was at an AA meeting, of all places, with my mom, and me and my little friends from AA were running around the AA meeting, right? And, we'd always ding-dong ditch and hit the same door, you know what I mean? The guy would chase after us. We'd hide in the meeting, and they'd, where's some damn kids? And the guys from AA would be like, there's no kids here, you know? But we would always mess around at the AA meetings, and it was at a hospital, and, you know, we were messing around one more time, I don't know, man. We were messing with this guy who's a chronic relapser. We didn't know at the time. We'd always just play with him, mess with him. And he came chasing after us, and we ran out up the hospital. And I was 9; these kids were 14. And we ran out the front door, and we ran up this parking structure, up the stairs. And I remember my heart just like like beating, right? That adrenaline of just running away from someone was just pounding, you know what I mean? And those kids pulled out a bottle of Jose Cuervo. Now, I didn't know what alcohol's going to do tumor for me. Like, I wasn't like, you know, because you remember the day before, I'm like just saying no. I got the whole arm full of the red bands, just saying no, promising my mom I'm not going to drink or use drugs ever, you know? And those kids pulled out a bottle of Jose Cuervo. And what my head said that day was, if you don't drink it, you're not going to be liked. Totally forgot, right? Like, totally forgot. Like, I want some friends, you know, little poopy pants want some friends. And so I took a pull off that tequila bottle, and I don't know what it was like the first time you drank tequila, but I hated the taste. I was like, oh, this is nasty, dude. It burned. I was like, oh. And I was overcome with fear, and that fear told me was that I was not going to be like the rest of my life. Now, I don't know where that thought came from, but that was the voice, you know. And so the bottle went around the second. And the second time I got that bottle, I was excited about having it. Now, I wasn't excited about getting drunk. I was excited about having some friends. So I talked myself into holding that tequila down, and I remember talking myself, and I remember holding that tequila down that day, and I can tell you the exact effect that alcohol has on this alcoholic body. In that moment, I connected with those kids. In that moment, I felt a part of. In that moment, right, there was a sense of connection, right? The disease of alcoholism is, if you're new, is a spiritual malady. Right? The spiritual malady for me is a spiritual disconnect. I'm disconnected from you, I'm disconnected from myself, and I'm disconnected from God. You know, my grandma was a good church going woman, and she would take me to church, and the music would be going, and the band, and my grandma would jump up and woo, start dancing. She'd want to grab my hands and dance around, and I just didn't feel the same thing my grandma felt. My grandma would hoot and holler and hallelujah, and I'd be like, dude, grandma, what you tripping on? You know what I mean? And that day what happened for me was I had that same feeling that my grandma had at church. And I didn't start drinking every day at 9. Mom was going to AA. It was hard to get booze at mom's house, you know what I'm saying? But at 11 years old, this kid handed me a joint. I smoked it, man, and this little elf chased me around the park, and I was like, oh my God, like every single person in my life told me if I smoked weed, bad things were going to happen, and nothing bad happened to me. Except I said, everybody is a bunch of liars. They don't tell you the truth. They lie to you. They try to scare you into things they don't want you to do. Don't listen to them anymore. So around that age, 11, 12, I stopped listening to people. And by the time I was in high school, right, that's like when the middle fingers came up. But when I got to high school, I grew up in Mission Viejo, California. I'm not sure, like Visalia, I'm not sure, like, the demographic there. But Mission Viejo, California is a suburb. And they wouldn't let us buy that rap music, you know what I'm saying? Now, you got to remember, this was like Two Live Crew. They started putting, like, parental advisory on the CDs. You couldn't buy, you had to be an adult, so we stole it. And then, you know, and I'm wearing, like, you know, listening to, like, Eazy-E and NWA and Ice Cube, and I got size 50 Dickies pulled all the way up, and I got a 5XL sweatshirt on, and I drink St. Ives out of a brown paper bag. You know what I mean? I'm like, I'm not being influenced. Now I'm pouring beer in the curb for the dead homies, you know what I'm saying? And I don't have any dead homies, but I'm getting ready for some, you know what I'm saying? And right, because, like, you gotta remember, like, I'm awkward poopy pants guy. St. Ives, gang member, you know what I mean? All of a sudden I start saying things like, orale, what's up, you know? And I got big friends, and I got a big mouth, and I talk a lot of crap, and then you want to fight me, and then I tell my friends to beat you up, and I'm like, na 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 na, you know? I'm just a straight cow. Like, alcohol gives me a sense of power. It gives me that courage that I need to walk through this thing called life. And I didn't know that at the time, you know. Mom's like, hey, you can't drink in my house, sober house. And so, you know, I don't listen to that crap, you know what I'm saying? And so I hide it better, you know. Mom finds weed. She can't smoke weed. Now I'm already coming home every night blacked out, and every night, my good AA mom. And 17, mom found a bag of weed one more time, and I came home, and she said, you're kicked out of the house. I mean, that's what I heard. I mean, I heard you're kicked out of the house. Since coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I've learned that I have a hearing problem. Right now, this is an important part of my, right? Like, I've already talked about the effect that alcohol has on me. Right? Mom's like, you can't drink in my house. I hear, hide it better. Right? There's already things that are occurring in my life that is telling me that I have to stop drinking. But alcohol's making decisions for me, and I don't even know it. My mom said, you're kicked out at 17. I walked in my bedroom. I packed my backpack at 17. And I walked by my mom and I looked her right in the eyes and I said, I'm going to do everything I can to ruin your life. And my mom was my hero. Alcohol made that decision for me. And alcohol is going to make the next decision for me. Because I don't know how you deal with shame and guilt. But this alcoholic arrogance came out. I puffed my chest. I grabbed my mom by the collar and I slammed her against the wall. F you. I hate you. You're never going to see me again. And I watched my mom's heart break right in that moment. Now, I don't know how you deal with shame and guilt. I don't know how you do it. But I run. And I run, and I run, and I run. And my mom doesn't hear from me for a year and a half. And the first call that my mom got was that I got in an accident, and I was bleeding out. And my mom was so terrified that she was going to get the call that her son bled out. And I said, Mom, I need to go to the hospital. I got in a car accident, and I don't know what to do. And my mom's like, well, you're in San Francisco and I'm in Orange County. Like, I don't know how I'm going to, you know, how I'm going to help. I said, well, I just don't know how I'm going to pay for the hospital. And she said, well, why don't you give me an address and I'll send them a check. And I said, oh, no, Mom, they need cash. My mom's like, they need cash. Like, how am I going to give you cash? I said, there's this thing called Western Union right down the street from your work. And you go down there and you pay the money and I can pick it up in San Francisco. Now, my mom is so scared she's going to get the call that I bled out. My mom ran down that liquor store that fast to wire me that $150. And a week later, I got in another accident and my mom wired me $150. And a week later, I got in another accident. My mom wired me $150. And this would go from the age of 17 till I got sober at 27 years old. And I already identified my alcoholism. That when I put alcohol in this alcoholic body, there's nothing that's going to get in the way of me to stop me. But it's going to take me 10 years. Disease of alcoholism is progressive. In 2000, what happened for me is I lost an important job, and I called my mom and asked for help, and she sent me to treatment. And if you're in treatment, like I don't have an opinion on treatment. It's actually an outside issue. But I didn't really hear the things I needed to hear. I heard about a frontal lobe cortex. I heard about a medical model. I heard some things like that. I fell in love in treatment. I know you're not falling in love at the treatment center you're at, but I did. It's really easy to do treatment when you're in love. You know what I'm saying? Right there, you guys, some of you are in love right now. Now, we weren't even allowed to have a conversation. We fell in love writing notes. You know what I'm saying? You looked at each other across the room, you know, batting those eyes. You could feel that energy. You know what I'm saying? You know what I mean? And we had the same sobriety date. You know, this is like, oh my God, this was like, dude, right? You guys know where we're going with this one? You know, I admitted to my innermost self I was an alcoholic and a drug addict. Didn't even know what that meant, but I said it to the counselor because I'm in love. And when you're in love, you got the pom-poms out for recovery and you're reading the big book. You know what I mean? You got little book studies going on. And, you know what I mean? And one day she didn't give me a note and I was like, got suicidal. You know what I mean? I was like, ecstatic recovery, suicidal. Doctors would give you pills for that stuff. You know what I'm saying? I'm not going to give it. You know, we all know the manipulation. We get them pills, you know, but they did some interventions and basically I'll go to group, you know. I go to group and she's standing there and she gave me a note and it was like getting hugged by God straight up, man. I ran back to Mark, my counselor's office, and said, Mark, I said, I've come to believe there's a power greater than myself that's going to restore me to sanity, man. And I truly believed it was God. I had no idea it was that note. Mark's like, you're doing such a good job. You got to do a 9-month program. And so I wrote my girlfriend a note. And she's like, let's go to Hawaii. And I'm like, dude, romance too. You got to do a 9-month program. I have to do a 9-month program. This is that God's will that Mark's talking about, man. I ran back to Mark's office and I said, Mark, I'm making a decision to do what God tells me to do. And she wants to go to Hawaii. I mean, God said I should go to Hawaii. So I did. And I got on the plane to go to Hawaii to be with my sober girlfriend, to be at Sober Living. And the flight attendant asked me what I wanted to drink. I was a heroin addict. I wasn't an alcoholic, though I identified my alcoholism at 17. And so I ordered a Heineken, right? Because that's what you do to be with your sober girlfriend in Sober Living. And 12 or 13 Heinekens later, I landed in Hawaii. I didn't hear anything about a phenomenon of craving or anything like that, man. I just took the drink and boom, I was drunk. And it took me 2 years till I got to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have 10 minutes left to share. And so I'm trying to figure out where I want to go at this point. I came in and out of it. Here's the deal, man. I came in and out of AA, I don't know if you've come in and out of AA, you know what I'm saying? Anyways, my mom would be like, you need to go to AA meeting, you know what I mean? So I would go to the AA meeting to get the money. And because she went to Al-Anon, and she started saying things like, no, you know what I mean? No. She's like, yeah, no's a full sentence, you know, or I'm going to set a boundary, you know that language that Al-Anon speak, you know what I mean? I hated Al-Anon then, you know what I'm saying? They screwed up my drinking, or they screwed up my getting my money. And so what happened was I would go to AA and they would say, are there any newcomers? And I'd raise my hand and I'd say, my name is Pat and I'm an addict. Aw, dude, you know how that is in AA. Maybe not in Visalia, but all the long timers are like, there's an addict in our room. Let's get him out of here. You know what I mean? And I'm like, screw you guys. And I leave AA and I slam the door for effects. I want you guys to know how pissed off I am. And no one ever followed me out of the room and said, hey, angry kid, here's a big book. You know, take this thing home or to your bush or wherever you're living and read it. Maybe you might identify with alcoholism, you know? And I'd go out there and I'd die. And I come back to AA not identifying and in and out, in and out. And then they, are there any newcomers? Oh, yeah, right here. Yeah, my name is Pat. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. And then some guy goes, oh, put $2 in the basket. Some are sicker than others. You know what I mean? I'm like, screw you guys. And I leave AA and I slam the door for effect. So, you know, pissed off. And no one ever came out and said, hi, my name's Fred. You want to go get some pie? Let me tell you my story. You know, and I go out there and I die. And long story short, I came out of a blackout, sexually assaulted. I left that motel that day. And that was going to be the first one. And I left, and I knew that if there's a liquor store across the street, I was like, if I just get a pint of tequila, everything would be all right. I got this shame and that guilt, that remorse, just like that self-hatred and that mind is going. And I reached my hand in my pockets. I didn't have enough money for a pint of tequila, but I had a guy's number from AA, and I said, man, I need help, you know. And he said, promise me you won't drink. Take me 20 minutes to get there. I said, man, I promise, man. I promised every day I came to AA, and I was drunk just like that every time, you know. So what was the difference that day? I made a promise, and I meant the promise with everything in me. And I hung up the phone. I walked in that liquor store to get a pack of cigarettes, and somehow I got a pint of tequila. Put that thing back, and I blacked out, and I came to on the North Shore of Hawaii, and I was at the AA camp out, countdown. Some guy 44 years was welcoming the newest newcomer. But this little old lady named Myrtle came up to me, and she said, hi, son. She said, my name's Myrtle. And I'm thinking, oh, great, Myrtle. Are you trying to pick up on me? You know, I didn't think, you know. And she said, come with me, kid. I got a job for you. And she gave me a spoon. And she said, you're going to serve ice cream at the ice cream social. You know, I'm thinking, oh, that's what I want to do, Myrtle. Serve ice cream at the ice cream social. And my hand was shaking, and she had another job. And we picked up trash for the next 30 minutes. And I'll never forget Myrtle. Yeah. I hope that I never get jaded in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I can't give that unconditional love that you guys have always given me. So I remember sitting down with Myrtle, and she said, how do you feel, kid? And for the first time in a really long time, I didn't think about drinking, and I didn't think about killing myself. But if service was enough to keep me sober, I never drank again. That guy dropped me back off that liquor store. I walked in that liquor store. I got a pint of tequila. I was drunk just like that. And I manipulated my mom to get back to the mainland, and the last year and a half of my drinking was downtown LA on Skid Row. I'm a straight man, but I would prostitute myself to men for one more drink, one more drug. I was sexually assaulted 12 times when I got to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. On October 23rd, 2002, I came to with a guy knowing exactly what I did the night before, but I had a spiritual defense that walked right in between me and that first drink. And that spiritual defense said this, call your mom and ask for help. I picked up the phone, I called my mom, and I asked for help. And my mom said, just stay where you are. Someone from AA will come and get you. So if I come and get you, I'm going to end up killing you. And she hung up on me. And these two goofy dudes came and got me that day, man. This guy had crazy hair. He didn't even knock. He just bars right in that motel, and he goes, my name's Jack, I'm an alcoholic. This other guy was on a walker. He's like, my name's John, I got 90 days. You know what I mean? They had the big books in their hand. We got the big books, and they're, oh yeah, they're on fire for AA. You know what I mean? And I'm just like, oh my God, this is like the epitome of lame. You know what I'm saying? And but the guy Jack goes, come with me, kid. Now, I know God is working in my life. Though I didn't believe in God for 10 years, I know that God is working in my life that day because that guy Jack said, come with me, kid. I followed that guy, and I got off the bed, out that bed, and I followed that guy to that motel. And if you're new, I don't know how we do it in Zoom, but the old timers always said, just get in the car, kid. And I remember getting in the car and getting in the car and getting in the car and hearing story after story after story, all the way to the meeting, the story, getting to the meeting and hearing the story, leaving the meeting and hearing stories. And I'm so grateful that AA is a storytelling society. Because through Jack telling me a story, talking about when he drank, he went to the hospital, John laughing, John telling the story of drinking and going to the hospital, Jack laughing, what happened for me was I started to look at when I drink, what happens to me. Now, I have a separator, right? My mind says, I don't go to the hospital. And Jack knew what was up. Jack said, well, what happens when you drink, Pat? I said, I go to jail. And so he goes, hey, Pete, come on over. Meet this new guy, Pat. And this guy, Pete, came over. And Jack goes, hey, Pete, when you drink, what happens to you? Pete goes, oh, man, I drink and I go to jail. And I laughed. And I told a story. And Pete told a story. And Pete called Justin. And Justin came over. And Justin got another Justin. And we all of a sudden were telling story after story about drinking and going to jail. And he came over, Jack, and he said, Pat, when you're in jail, what happens? I said, well, I go to jail and H&I comes and I make a promise to my mom I'm not going to drink. And I go to church and I mean it with everything in me. But an hour before I got out of jail, I started having a conversation with myself. He said, what does the conversation say? I said, the conversation always says, Pat, alcohol isn't your problem. And I get out of jail and I drink. And he says, what happens? I say, I do all this other stuff and then I end up back in jail. He said, what happens that time? I said, I make a promise. And I do this time and time and time and time and time and time again. And he looked at me and he said, Pat, if you can conceive both propositions, physical, that when you put alcohol into your body, you can't stop until you get to jail. And more importantly, that when you're in jail, you're trying to figure out how you can control and enjoy your drinking without ending up back in jail. He said, you might be alcoholic. And I am so grateful that that man didn't tell me that I was an alcoholic. He allowed me to be with me. He allowed me to concede to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. And it was the greatest gift that you guys gave me, was a gift of identification. Because I was no longer different from you. That means when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was one amongst many. Every time I said I was an alcoholic and an addict, I separated myself from the solution that Alcoholics Anonymous had to offer, and I left every time. Time in and time out. And I'm so grateful for the responsibility statement that says, when anyone anywhere reaches out for help, we want the hand of AA to be there, and for that I'm responsible. It is still my responsibility as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous that when a dope fiend or an addict or someone with something else other than what we have here in Alcoholics, it's still my responsibility to know members of other fellowships, right? Not just to say, hey, go to NA, hey, go to CA, go. It's still my responsibility to call one of those members up and go, I got a new guy for you. Can we meet at Denny's? And hand that guy off to a member of another fellowship in order for, because God brought him to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that guy was on frick fire for AA guy, dude. You know what I mean? You know those guys. You got a couple of them in this group. You know what I mean? They're annoying as heck, man. But he took me to every potluck. He took me to every meeting everywhere. He needed to introduce me to everybody. And he rode my butt for the steps. I mean, I was making amends at 90 days of sobriety. I was writing inventory day one. The first amends I made was to the court at 4 days I had turned myself in, which he said it was going to be all right. I spent 100 days in jail. You know, I didn't think how that was all right. But looking back, it was the greatest gift they gave me. I haven't had to go to jail since then. You know, I came to believe in AA. I made a decision to do what that guy told me to do. 90 days sober, made amends to my mom. I sat down with my mom, and I owe my mom hundreds of thousands of dollars. And all she wanted me to do is get in the middle of AA and help people. And so I went back to my sponsor. I'm like, this AA thing's amazing, man. She just wants me to get in the middle of AA. We're healing. We love each other. Oh, man. You know, and he said, what about the money? I said, she didn't want the money. He said, yeah, but AA wants you to pay it back. And I thought, don't ever tell this guy anything ever again, you know. I had to write a note to my mom every day, Mom, or once a week. Mom, I love you and I appreciate you. Didn't leave her $25. Oh, my God, it's going to be a lifetime paying the money off. He said, you'll do it $25 at a time. Oh, my God. Jeez, $25 at a time. This guy's lost his last wing. But I did. Put the money, wrote the note. Put the money, wrote the note. Put the money, wrote the note. 6 months in, he goes, hey, kid. I said, yes, sir. He said, I want you to write the note every day. Leave the money once a week. So every day I'm writing the note, leaving the money once a week. Every day writing the note, leaving the money once a week. 5 years in, my mom sits me down and she says, Patrick, I no longer want the money anymore, but I still want the notes. I can tell you, I wrote a note to my mom, sent my mom a text, or called my mom just about every day until the day my mom died. You know, when I was 2 years sober, my mom was diagnosed with COPD. Her pride wouldn't let her wear that damn oxygen machine. The last 3 years of her life, she wore oxygen, and she wore it like nobody's business. You know, I'm going to go all the way to SIS, Ada, I hope you don't mind. And if I have to talk about my mom, because you guys know my mom. And so my mom, she the last 3 years, she right before her 40th, she got off life support. She made it, lived 3 years. I'd go every Monday to see my mom because that's what I had to do for the amends with my son. And my mom was like hugging a cactus. She loved the women in AA. But man, it was like, dude, it was hard learning how to love my mom. And I didn't want to do the Monday deal. And my friend Michelle said, "You're going to have to teach your mom how to love you." What do you mean, teach my mom? She should be teaching me. And so every Monday I would go there and I'd grab her on the cheeks and I'd kiss her and she'd just, you know. And one time we were in Nebraska speaking together and, man, my mom couldn't breathe, you know. I said, "Just get in the wheelchair, Mom." You know, she wouldn't get in the wheelchair. That pride, you know, "I'm not getting in that goddamn wheelchair." I said, "Just get in the wheelchair." She wouldn't get in the wheelchair. I remember looking at my mom and I said, "Mom, when are you going to let me love you?" And my mom sat in the wheelchair. I was so proud. Man, I was walking my mom in the wheelchair. Now I got an alcoholic thought, man. All of a sudden, I started running with my mom in the wheelchair. This is like downward slope. I jumped up. I kicked my feet up in the air. The wheelchair was going like this. She's screaming and yelling at me. Stop, stop, stop. We got to the bottom and something changed. Our relationship went from a son-mother authoritative relationship to an innocent childlike relationship. We got to the hotel and I went left and I came back. My mom, the next morning, I turned the water on. All this red water came out of the shower head. My mom had snuck in there and put a dye tablet in there. And I got out of the shower and she was like this, "Gotcha," you know. And we had a playful relationship for the next, you know, 3 years. And in the last 5 weeks, my mom was on hospice. And what happened was she had a tumor that blocked the passageway. She couldn't breathe. And she was operating on 30% of one lung for the last 3 years of her life. But she charged. She was at 7 meetings a week, sitting down with women, reading the book all the way up until she went on hospice. And when she was on hospice, women came to my mom's house. Man, I knew it was the end, you know. And I would come to AA and I'd hear your stories. You guys would talk about the greatest gift AA gave you was the gift to be there when your loved one took their last breath. And I wanted your experience, you know. And I'd go see my mom and she'd look at me and she'd say, "Patrick, don't sit here and watch me die. Go out there and live your life. But please come back tomorrow and give me a kiss, will you?" And it was so hard, but I would go out there and I'd live my life. And I'd come back the next morning, I'd give my mom a kiss, and I'd talk to her, and I'd connect with her, and she'd say, "Don't sit here and watch me die. Go out there and live your life." And I would do that. And, you know, I was going to speak in Seattle at a convention, and she's going to be gone for 5 days, man, and I didn't want to miss my mom's last breath. So I say a prayer. "God, what do you want me to do?" And I sit in meditation, and the answer was, "Go be of service to Alcoholics Anonymous." Well, I don't like that answer, so I pray the next day. I get the same answer. I don't like that answer, so I pray the third day. I get the same answer, so then I go, "I think I'll call my sponsor." So I call my sponsor, and he goes, "What did God want you to do?" I said, "God keeps telling me to go be of service to Alcoholics Anonymous." He said, "Then that's what you need to go do." And so I went, and the day three, I get a call. "So you need to hurry up and get back, man. Your mom hasn't moved. She hasn't talked. She's been unresponsive." I said a prayer, and the message was, "Stay and be a service to Alcoholics Anonymous." The fifth day, man, I got in my car, plane land, I get in my car, I fly to my mom's house, I walk in, and my mom sat straight up like this and put her arms out. Spirit felt spirit walk in that room that day. I went into my mom's arms, she held on to me, and she said, "Pato, I want you to know you did the right thing." She held on to me and she said, "Pato, I love you, I love you, I love you." And that was the last words that my mom said. And when my mom died, my heart broke. I can't force a forgiveness. I never have been able to force a surrender. But by taking the little steps in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're new, the main problem the alcoholic centers in his mind. If I would have listened to the mind that said not to show up on Monday night, if I would have listened to the mind that said, I'm not going to teach my mom how to love me, if I'd listened to the mind that said, "I'm not going to, I don't want to, I'm not going to do this," I would have missed the miracle. by taking little bit of actions over 17 years of sobriety. In that moment when my mom held me and she said, "Pato, I want you to know you did the right thing," was all my mom wanted from me. When I made that amends to her at 90 days of sobriety, was to get in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous and help as many people as I could. And I honored my mom's amends all the way until the day my mom died. And right before my mom died, I held on to my mom, I kissed her on the forehead, and I said, "Mom, I'll make sure to carry on your legacy." If you're new here in Alcoholics Anonymous is a lot more than just not drinking. Alcoholics Anonymous is a process of growing up. And it's my prayer every night that if you're new, you find a sponsor that cares more about your life than the way you feel. I want to thank your group for having me tonight. I love you all. Thank you very much.